Back in May, during the belated House of Commons debate on Afghanistan, Jack Layton took the position that Canada's role in Afghanistan today should build on our strengths and reputation as a peacekeeping nation. This morning, World Report takes a critical look at some of the darker moments in Canadian peacekeeping. Peacekeeping. The word alone seems to have taken on an unshakable, positive connotation, which everyone seems to want a piece of. It reminds us of Lester B. Pearson, the father of peacekeeping, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1957 for his role in defusing the Suez Crisis. It evokes images of the Cold War era when peacekeeping resolved conflicts between states by deploying unarmed or lightly armed soldiers from a number of countries under UN command. Normally, a ceasefire was already in place. The parties to the conflict had to give their consent to the introduction of peacekeepers. Consent meant that peacekeepers neither needed nor were permitted to use force for anything but self-defense. And the peacekeeping forces were expected to maintain a strict neutrality toward all local parties and combatants. The Blue Helmets themselves monitored ceasefires, patrolled demilitarized zones, blocked the flow of weapons, assisted with the demilitarization and disarmament, protected UN civilian personnel, aid workers, and local noncombatants, and facilitated the post-conflict reconstruction of everything from roads to governing institutions. So successful were they that UN peacekeeping forces themselves were awarded the Nobel Prize in 1988. According to the press release from the Nobel Organization, the peacekeeping forces of the United Nations have, under extremely difficult conditions, contributed to reducing tensions where an armistice has been negotiated, but a peace treaty has yet to be established. In situations of this kind, the UN forces represent the manifest will of the community of nations to achieve peace through negotiations, and the forces have, by their presence, made a decisive contribution towards the initiation of actual peace negotiations. Such was the force of these considerations that others were inspired to imitate, or at least to appropriate the language of, peacekeeping. In 1979, when the peace treaty was signed between Egypt and Israel, the UN decided to withdraw its peacekeepers from the Sinai Peninsula. However, the terms of the treaty required the presence of international peacekeepers, so when the UN could not be persuaded to stay, Egypt, Israel, and the United States negotiated an organization outside the UN. The result is an 11-nation peacekeeping force known as the Multinational Force and Observers. Again, in 1987, an Indian peacekeeping force, or IPKF, entered Sri Lanka to keep the peace between the Tamil Tigers and the Sri Lankan armed forces. The IPKF was drawn into conflict later that year. Supported by Indian Army tanks, helicopter gunships, and heavy artillery, the IPKF temporarily routed the Tigers. The IPKF was not a classic peacekeeping operation on the UN model. Its troops were not lightly armed, and it did not maintain neutrality toward the combatants. Today, even NATO asserts that it is, quote, playing an increasingly important role in peacekeeping, end quote. When NATO speaks of peacekeeping, the word may refer to operations that require airborne forces, mechanized infantry, attack helicopters, and artillery. Although the majority of UN peacekeeping operations are successful, the concept of what peacekeeping actually is has changed under the pressure of several spectacular failures. In Canada, the first of these is a festering piece of unfinished business known as the Somalia Affair. It began in 1992 with a phone call from George H.W. Bush inviting his friend Brian Mulroney to join the U.S.-led relief mission to Somalia. Canadian forces were overextended at the time. Moreover, the military brass had been warned that the elite Canadian Airborne Regiment was poorly trained, undisciplined, and ill-equipped for the job. But two top defense officials, Chief of Staff General John de Chastelain and Deputy Minister of Defense Robert Fowler, wanted a prominent role in a high-profile mission that would remove the memory of Canada's relatively minor participation in the Gulf War. Mulroney jumped at the chance. There was no ceasefire. Neither had parties to the Civil War consented to a UN operation. Once in the field, the Canadian paratroopers' enthusiasm for helping the Somalis faded. The Canadians were harassed and threatened as they tried to rebuild bridges, roads, and hospitals destroyed in the warfare. Once, they were pelted with stones while escorting a food convoy. Even more galling was the incessant stream of desperate Somalis sneaking into the Canadian compound at night to steal food and anything else they could scavenge. Then on March 4, 1993, a plot was hatched. Using food and water as bait, a team of Canadian soldiers, including a sniper, lay waiting in the dark. Two Somalis crawled through the fence and grabbed the food. The soldiers ordered them to halt. When the Somalis turned and ran, the Canadians, equipped with night vision goggles, shot both of them in the back. One died. Just a little over a week later, on March 19th, Jim Day, then a reporter for the small daily newspaper, the Pembroke Observer, happened to be on assignment in Somalia and saw medical staff rushing Corporal Clayton Machi by stretcher to the hospital. Day recalled, quote, "When I asked, they were very abrupt and defensive," end quote. Only 2.5 days before, the bloody, mutilated body of Somali teenager Shidani Arone, who had been shot about 1.5 weeks before, arrived at the same hospital. Arone had been in the custody of Mache and the other airborne paratroopers. According to later court-martial testimony, the corporal went berserk, savagely punching and kicking Arone and using cigarillos to burn the teenager, even as the Somali pleaded, "Canada, Canada, Canada," in a futile bid to halt the three-hour-long torture. Under custody in a temporary detention bunker, Mache tried to hang himself with a bootlace, but a guard discovered him before he finished the job. Kim Campbell, who was Minister of Defense at the time, was caught off guard. She said that while she learned about the death 2 days after it happened, it took another 2 weeks before she heard it might have been murder. The Liberal opposition claimed she had known the details of the case from the beginning. The scandal broke while Campbell was preparing her successful bid for the Progressive Conservative leadership and dogged her throughout the disastrous 1993 election campaign. The PCs won only 2 seats. In retrospect, they were effectively finished as a party. Peacekeeping in Somalia was not just a Canadian disaster. On October 3, 1993, the peace enforcement and nation-building mission of UNOSOM II suddenly turned violent when a U.S. offensive operation, codenamed Task Force Ranger, came under heavy fire from Somali gunmen. Locals saw the U.S. and U.N. supporting one clan, Ali Mahdi, over that of the rival, one led by Idid. This was further compounded by the July 12th missile attack by the U.S. on a meeting including members of Idid's clan who were arguing for negotiation. Not only was there no ceasefire and no consent from the warring parties, there was no neutrality and no sense whatever in which the peacekeepers fired only in self-defense. All 4 characteristics of classic U.N. peacekeeping were violated. The attack on Task Force Ranger ultimately led to one of the worst military defeats of a U.S. military force since the Vietnam War. Back in Canada, the Liberals, once elected, moved to put the scandal behind them. It heated up again in January 1995. A videotape showing soldiers from the airborne regiment being forced to eat urine-soaked bread as part of an initiation ritual led the government to disband the regiment. Then in the spring of 1995, Major Barry Armstrong, a doctor who had served in Somalia, alleged that the Somali killed on March 4th had been executed. He had been shot in the back of the head at point-blank range. Defense Minister David Collinet was forced to call an inquiry. Under Gilles Letourneau, a Federal Court of Canada judge, the Somalia Commission ran from October 1995 until Chrétien's Liberals abruptly shut it down in January 1997. Still, there was a final report. The 3-member commission concluded that, quote, The sorry sequence of events in Somalia was not the work of a few bad apples, but the inevitable result of systematic organization and leadership failures, many occurring over long periods of time and ignored by our military leaders for just as long. End quote. They said that the nation's military system was, quote, rotten to the core, and that sweeping change was the only way, quote, to recapture lost faith in the Canadian forces and to restore honor to our traditional role as international peacekeepers, end quote. Before long, the Canadian public wearied of the Somalia affair. It had outlasted four defense ministers, liberal and conservative. Each new revelation had been worse than the last. A period of denial regarding Canada's military was well underway. Now Jack Layton seems to have forgotten that there was ever any question about our traditional role as international peacekeepers, and this week Stephen Harper is set to announce $15 billion in new military spending. In those days, at first, Rwanda was gathering on the horizon. Then in 1994, it rose up like a vast and sudden tidal wave and swept away the memory of one teenager's death in Somalia. What followed, especially for those who view peacekeeping as a treasured national institution, was one cautionary tale after another. Those who want to make Canada a proud peacekeeper again have their work cut out for them. This edition of World Report has been archived on the World Report website at cjly.net/worldreport. There are also links to recommended sources of further reading if you're interested. To comment or suggest a story, send email to earthling@cjly.net or snail mail to Box 767, Nelson, British Columbia, Canada, V1L5R4. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.